And that's the kicky music that means it is time again for Pop Culture Happy Hour. I'm Linda Holmes. I'm the editor of NPR's pop culture and entertainment blog, Monkey See. On this week's show, we'll touch on a recent casting announcement that predictably has the internet buzzing. We'll look at the pending return of one of television's most admired comedies, well, maybe comedies, and we'll close the show with what's making us happy this week. Before we get started here in historic Studio 44, let's go around the table. Stephen Thompson, what do you do at NPR?
I am a writer and editor with NPR Music.
And Petra Mayer, what do you do at NPR?
Hi, I'm an editor with NPR Books.
And Glenn Weldon, what do you do at NPR?
I write about books and comic books for the NPR website.
It was a big weekend for you, Glenn.
It was an exhausting weekend.
Well, I mean, for one thing, as I understand it, you are now a homeowner.
I am, yes.
Yeah, but also...
Amortizing to beat the band.
Right, but also it was Free Comic Book Day.
It was. I didn't get out because I was writing a book, but...
I was going to say, which of those things did you spend more money on?
Yeah, right. I didn't get out, actually, because I was writing a book, but I did see some very heartwarming messages on the Facebook page.
Yeah.
And I was tweeted at about people who went out there for the first time and bought their books for their sons and daughters. It was awesome.
I feel like this was the year people started listening to you.
Yeah, about that. 5 years. That's usually the way it works.
I felt like this was the year it sunk in.
Yeah.
You know? How many books did you have to... There were like 50 of them.
57.
Yeah, he was thorough. He was thorough, and I know because I edited that piece. All right, so while Glenn was off worrying about Free Comic Book Day and homeownership and other things were happening, there was this casting announcement that came out accompanied by a charming black and white photograph of a bunch of people sitting around a living room with J.J. Abrams. And they sort of said, oh, it's the cast of the next Star Wars movie because, you know, believe it or not, someone is clamoring. It's not me. I was trying to remember. I very much like the original trilogy by which I, you know, which I refer to as the real movies.
Sure.
Then there are the prequels, which I know I saw the first one. I'm not sure.
Subtitled 3 hours closer to death with nothing to show for it.
I'm not sure if I saw the other two or not, to tell you the truth, or if it's just one long memory of seeing the first one.
Yep.
But they are going to do the last three, which are actually the chronological last three. You know, they did the middle three and the first three. Now they're doing the last three because that's how you do it.
Sure.
Naturally. And this is going to be J.J. Abrams because that's the law.
It's J.J. Abrams. That's the law, not George Lucas. So the assumption is that a surer hand is at the helm as far as script writing and characterization. And
I don't know.
Are we thinking that?
I don't know.
That is the sound of me zipping my lips so hard it can be heard in Peoria.
Because?
Well, I mean, I think the thing that, when you asked me to do this, I said, oh God, I'm Trek, not Wars. What am I going to say about Star Wars? But of course, J.J. Abrams did the Star Trek movies, which you could have a whole philosophical debate about whether or not they were true to the exploratory and peaceful spirit of the original series, which no, but they were still fun to watch.
Mm-hmm.
So, and here's where I guess I make a joke about lens flare, right?
Yeah.
Sure. It's the law.
I think that's the
law. Yeah, that is also the law. They announced the new Star Wars cast, and apart from Carrie Fisher, there is one female role.
Mm-hmm. And one African-American actor, I believe. Mm-hmm. The guy from Attack the Block, yeah?
Yep.
Yeah,
which,
a movie Glenn cool. likes very much.
I do. But that's the pattern, right? I mean,
yeah.
you get one a female who is invariably a princess. A princess who can hold her own. A princess who's good with a blaster, but still a princess.
Mm-hmm.
And a black dude. Or one person of color.
Mm-hmm.
With a speaking role.
Yeah.
And some in the back. And then lots and lots of horrible racial stereotyped aliens.
Yeah.
At least in the prequels.
And if it's like Star Trek Into Darkness, you have this strong female character with agency lavishly photographed in her bra.
Yes, yeah. Exactly. Going back to what Glenn said about princesses, this is the first Star Wars movie that's being made by Disney, notoriously a company that markets nothing but princesses.
Right.
You would think that they would want to add another princess to their lineup of
yeah.
creepy women who don't look at each other when they're all in the same picture.
Now, at the same time, I mean, let's keep in mind, they're not... I think I may be making the most obvious statement that has ever been made. I don't think they're quite done rolling out information related
sure.
to this movie.
Sure.
Yeah.
I think for about the next 20 months, we're going to get a trickle of now there's this character, now there's this character, now there's this character.
Yeah.
Oh, look, we added so-and-so, and this is going to happen, and that's going to happen, and here's
right.
a photo that may or may not be of the set of the blah, blah, blah. I mean, this is going to drive us bonkers for the next 20 months.
Right.
Yeah, when J.J. Abrams was remaking Star Trek, he had a cast that he literally had to recast. So he's kind of locked into that. We need new Uhura. Mm-hmm. Everybody else, white dudes, or variations on white dudes. Here, he could go anywhere. He could do anything, because he's not limited by George Lucas's plan, right? He's not following George Lucas's script. He's going off and doing what he wants to do, yes?
That depends. I'm not sure.
Other than the fact that, from what I've read, I mean, Harrison Ford is in this, Mark Hamill is in this, Carrie Fisher is in this.
Yeah.
They have as many original participants as they could cobble together, and it is set 30 years into the future. They're aging everybody 30 years from Return of the Jedi. And so you have all these actors who are in the first trilogy, you know, appearing age. So they're tethered to the original story in that way. Now they could go any number of directions, whether they have sons or daughters, mm-hmm. and you know, but it's not a completely entirely re-envisioned story, right? They're working somewhat off of George Lucas.
I mean, he's always said that he wants R2-D2 and C-3PO to be the kind of every man, every robot, every droid that goes through the entire process, and I'm sure they're going to keep that. Have we heard about Billy Dee Williams? Is he back? Has there been any news?
I don't remember seeing that in the announcement.
Because here's a character who was a character in the film that he premiered in Empire Strikes Back. And right. then in Return of the Jedi, he kind of faded into the background because there was right. a lot of stuff going on.
Yeah, and I completely agree with Stephen. We are not done getting information about this movie. They have already said, kind of as soon as this noticing of the sort of homogenous nature of this cast came out, there was some, well, there are still some people left to come, including one major female character. And, like, you know, a lot of sort of not backpedaling, but, you know.
Reassurance.
Behind covering happened right away. And that's all fine. And I don't question that. It doesn't mean the movie is going to be bad. It doesn't mean that I'm not going to see it. It doesn't mean it's not going to be brilliant. There are brilliant movies made up of casts of white dudes, and it's not that there can't be. But you can't be defensive about right. people looking at a bunch of white dudes and saying, the first thing I notice is that that is a cast of white dudes. And when people started to bring this up, there kind of gets to be this somewhat prickly reaction of saying, the word that I heard was audit. It's ridiculous to go through and audit the cast for sort of diversity. And
you mean looking at them with your eyes?
And that's, but you know, it's you say that, but that is kind of, I think the problem with that approach is that it assumes that looking at the diversity of a cast is a second undertaking after kind of your organic, natural reaction to it. Then you go back and look at it for diversity. And I can tell you that, granted, you know, I absolutely write about this stuff a lot. I think about this stuff a lot. So that's part of it. But when I look at a bunch of people in a room, if they are all white guys, it stands out to me right away. It's not something where I have to sit there and be like, okay, now I'm going to audit the cast for diversity. And it's the same thing, like, if you give me a list of, you know, 50 writers, how many of them are white people? How many of them are women? That kind of stuff, I noticed right away. It's in my taking in of that list in the first place. It's not a separate thing. And I think it's only a separate thing if you think of it like, you know, it's sort of, you know, the norm is for it to be a bunch of white dudes. You know, you can't expect every movie to be activist. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like that bothers me a little bit, because it's kind of like what you're saying, is that the audit that people are talking about is looking at the picture. They released the picture. What do you want me to do? Like, I look at it, and that's...
It's you were supposed to only smile approvingly at the picture.
Well, yeah. The other thing is, what are you supposed to notice about it? Like, what are you supposed to say about that cast? Like, what trenchant analysis is being pushed aside because you're focusing on the diversity of the cast?
They released it so you would get excited about Leia, Han, and Luke being in the cast. That's why they released it. They almost didn't think about everybody else around them. I guarantee you.
Well, and what I'm saying is, you got to start thinking about it.
Absolutely.
Because there's people like me out there in the world who, it stands out quickly. I don't know. Go ahead, Petra.
What also really disturbs me about this, which you just mentioned in passing, is that the idea that something that is not all white and male is by definition activist, as
right.
opposed to
yeah.
the right thing to do.
Right.
You know?
Well, and gives you the opportunity to tell a richer story, which is
right.
really a big component part. It's not just a matter of
right.
putting out a diverse cast. It's you just tell a better story that way.
And this came up in a conversation that I read recently with one of the people who was involved in making Noah. And our friend Audie Cornish, I believe, was the one who directed me to this story. Essentially, they asked about the fact that in Noah, this biblical epic that does not take place in Sweden, everybody in it was a white person. And they kind of asked, unfortunately, I don't remember who it was, but it was not Aronofsky, it was somebody else, maybe from casting, who was talking about casting that movie and said, Well, the thing is, if you get focused on trying to make it diverse, then you get focused on kind of a little bit of everybody, and it winds up looking like a Benetton ad, and it's very fake and distracting.
Maybe they could have had two of each race.
So basically what he winds up saying literally in this interview, and this is a real person who really gave this interview, basically he's like, we wanted to just say this is a story that's about all of humanity. And we didn't want it to be distracting that, like, it was a, you know, that you were trying to cram every kind of person in there. So we figured we just wanted them to be just, we didn't want to make it an issue. So we made them all white people.
And yeah. I was like, is this coming so across on mic? This is me palming my face so hard you can hear it.
Yeah. This particular franchise has had problems with this because they get so tunnel vision, because Lucas, when he was in charge, was such a technician. I mean, if you watch the director's commentary, he is talking about the background. He's talking about the green screen. He's never talked about an actor or a performance once in any of his. But he's a pure technician. And so for somebody like a character like Newt Gunray, who was the head of the Trade Federation, or Jar Jar Binks, who was whatever the hell he was, you have all this language that comes out of Lucasfilm about how they've hired linguists to create a special little dialect for him, and this reflects all these different kind of things. And it comes out a guy going, Atlita is perfectly valid, Senator. And you're like, you need to back up. You're zoomed in. You need
There's a forest for the trees thing.
There really is.
I never thought that I would be convinced to argue against world building in favor of crass marketing, but I think this is one of those cases because, I mean, this is also a company who, like, you know, they're desperately repurposing old movie merchandise as Frozen stuff because they can't keep it in stock. So you'd think that some market droid somewhere in Disney would say, hey, put a princess in there. Put another girl.
I think that cycle has not had a chance to play out yet. Right. But my guess is that as we go forward, there will be some of that, because some of those analyses are starting to come out more, where people point to profits for movies that have women in them and stuff.
We are still early enough in this process, that things can change. You mentioned marketing, Petra, and I just really hope that these movies give me an opportunity to repurpose my Jar Jar Binks KFC bucket topper, which was a smelly green foam disc that they used to top a big bucket of Kentucky Fried Chicken. So if you wanted your chicken to smell like plastic and vice versa, it was perfect.
Yeah, I mean, again, I want to make very clear, this is only one thing about this movie.
Of course.
First of all, we don't know exactly where they're going to wind up. Second of all, it's only one thing. It doesn't mean I'm not going to like the movie. I'm probably not going to like the movie, but that's not why.
Well, talk about J.J. Abrams, because, you know, the J.J. Abrams of Felicity, the J.J. Abrams of Alias, you know, kick-ass women in lead roles, becomes at some point the J.J. Abrams of Star Trek, where Nurse Chapel stands there in her bra for no reason.
Right. And it's particularly tone-deaf right now, given what's going on in the sci-fi and fantasy community and sort of all of geekdom. There's huge arguments roiling now about the role and treatment of women.
Right. The fan base has changed since the original trilogy, since the prequels, actually. It's still changed because cultures don't change because of one reason, but, I mean, certainly it's part of it is that nerds married nerds and had baby nerds, and those nerds grew up. It's certainly a part of the internet where you can at least hear more voices. I mean, there's all kinds of examples, and Petra knows them as well as I do, about examples of when the internet just attacks those voices. But they're certainly heard more, and certainly I think, and this is a broad sweeping generalization, I realize, but the fan fiction has helped a great deal. Fan fiction written largely...
Petra is clutching her heart in wonder and happiness.
Written largely by and sometimes for women has a different relationship with the text, with the franchise, that a predominantly male one would. Like, I would say the male reaction to Star Wars is to fetishize the text itself, to fetishize the objects about it, all the hardware. And the relationship fan fiction creates is one that's much more engaged, much more interactive. It goes into the text and messes around with it.
Right.
So it's not reverence. It's not fetishization, per se.
Can I just also say that in terms of female fans, fan fiction is largely by and for female, but we also can talk about cosplay. Female fans have been really engaged in taking the images of favorite characters and reworking them and gender swapping them. And, you know, I used to go to Dragon Con all the time down in Atlanta, and you always see the 501st Legion there, the Stormtroopers. And
what did you wear to Dragon Con?
I dressed up like Pizzazz from The Misfits.
Oh, okay.
Truly outrageous.
Awesome.
That's so awesome.
But there are female stormtroopers down there, and I refuse to believe that the people involved in the making of this movie are not aware of what's going on in fandom.
Right. I heard a new phrase to me the other day. It's not new. It was new to me the other day, which was that Will Wheaton had tweeted a picture of a woman dressed up as Wesley Crusher, and it said crossplay, mm-hmm. which I yep. was not, mm. that was not familiar to me. But she made a very attractive Wesley Crusher. I was like, that's fair. You know.
Now, we brought up the point of, you did, Linda, of whether you're going to like these movies. I come back to the reaction to particularly Star Wars Episode One, where there was so, I mean, it was the same kind of thing. It was just months and months and months and months and months of buildup. And it got to the point where I found myself wondering, like, is it even possible for people to have an opinion of this movie that can be in any way divorced from this gigantic web of nostalgia and expectations? I was trying to flash forward to December 18th, 2015, when I'm presumably going to have to watch this movie for this show, and sitting down and thinking, like, how are people going to be able to just sit down and just enjoy it as a piece of entertainment? Because I remember I worked at The Onion during Episode 1, and The Onion was staffed almost entirely by Star Wars nerds. I don't remember if we were able to put out a new issue that week, because like half the staff was in line in like Sith robes and, and whatnot. And
what did you wear?
I am not a Star Wars nerd.
He's not a Star Wars.
I waited,
a cosplay kind of guy.
Not particularly. I waited 6 months to see it. I saw it in a budget theater for $2 and just sat there like, all right.
I was going to say not in line the whole time.
Not in line the entire time. They're like, sir, you can come right in. It's like a noon showing. It's been out for months. And so I went in. I'm like, I am going to have the perfect way to see this because I have heard the backlash to the backlash, endlessly. I am going to enjoy this as a pure piece of garbage. I thought it was terrible. I hated it. The quote unquote best parts looked like a video game. It's awful. Yeah. Anyway, I just found every reaction to it. Now, I was marinating in this tepid soup of intense fandom. But, like, how do you just simply enjoy movies like this?
Well, you're fighting. You're right, Stephen. I mean, you're fighting to somebody like me who saw the first film when I was 7 years old, and it just poleaxed me. And I had every toy, and I had mm-hmm. the storybook, and I had the Marvel Oversized Treasury Edition comic. hearing the fanfare, seeing 20th Century Fox, seeing A Long Time Ago in a Galaxy Far, Far Away, and that crawl begins, that has a primal power over me. Unless that crawl contains the word Trade Federation, in which case I'm like, what? There's a trade war? What? Who's going with the... What happened? Where's Darth Vader?
Tort reform? What?
Yes, exactly. That's the thing. There is this incredible buildup, and then there's what we get. And I don't know. I think that's a very good question. I don't know. I mean, Abrams is an action director, right? He had a great mix of reverence for the source and tweaking it in Star Trek, in the first Star Trek anyway. So I'm encouraged by that.
Star Trek was my first fandom. I also have that Pavlovian response to the theme music. It makes me feel like I'm 12 again and happy and comforted watching this.
At 12?
Who was happy and comforted at 12?
Watching Star Trek, I was. Old Trek, mind you. Old Trek, mm-hmm. because I am also old. And, you know, I went into the J.J. Abrams movies with that predisposition to sort of suspend all of my critical faculties and just enjoy being at play in this world again.
So did it work?
It actually did, and even though I have major philosophical differences with the second movie, I still thought it was really fun and well-made and also contained Benedict Cumberbatch in tight black kicking people's butts. So I think it's possible to enjoy, if it is actually a well-made movie, to enjoy it whether or not it's true to all my dearly held thoughts about what the original thing was.
I think you're an outlier. I really do. I don't sense that sort of openness from the nerd community.
And remember that the...
I'm a fake nerd girl.
Let's get started down that rabbit hole. Even the second trilogy did not come out, the second Star Wars trilogy, did not come out as much in the age of social media and Twitter in particular. I feel like this particular movie, this is going to get picked over more than any
movie. It's true.
ever.
It's true.
It's going to be interesting so to see hard. How
witness, we are talking about it now. Yeah. Having seen a photo.
Yeah, it's
for
true.
Example.
It's absolutely
just
true.
Tossing that out there.
Absolutely true. Absolutely true. Well, you should come and find us on Facebook at facebook.com/PCHH or on the blog at npr.org/PCHH and tell us if you have feelings about Star Wars, about the new photo, about Star Trek, about J.J. Abrams.
If you have feelings about the photo.
I will say one thing that when I saw that, the first Star Wars film in when I was 7, the military stuff didn't land with me. All I wanted to know was more about who's this Darth Vader guy? Where does he come from? Mm-hmm. And what's this force power? How does that work?
Yeah.
If I could go back in time and slap myself around saying, you don't want to know any of that.
Yeah.
None of that. That's exactly what you never want to find out.
What was he like as a little kid?
What was the haircut like?
What's a midichlorian?
What's a bowl cut?
I wonder what he was like when he was my age.
Oh.
All right. So in the news of things that are substantially closer than 18 months off or whatever we are from this movie, the other thing we were going to talk about today is the fact that as we tape this on Monday, Louis is coming back tonight for its fourth season. And I think this is a half-hour show on FX hosted by Louis C.K. They brand it as a comedy. I find it to be kind of a blend of different things. And I think the main actual Louis fan person in the group is Glenn.
Yep.
So you have been watching this since the very beginning.
I have.
And you've seen all of it.
Uh-huh.
Give us sort of your sense of the show based on your viewing.
Well, this show is about as close as it gets to seeing short films on American television. Or I would put it as short stories. Mm-hmm. It's like a collection of short stories that kind of has a central character who is, not to take the entire podcast down the same road again, but like a straight white dude who can't catch a break. You know, the guy just can't catch a break. That's the sitcom premise that has been around forever.
Yeah.
And the thing that he's doing, because he is the writer, he is the director, he is involved in casting, he's involved in picking the music. That's another reason why it feels like a set of short stories to me, because I do get this one singular voice. The reality of the show and the continuity of the show can kind of go feathery around the edges, depending on what story he wants to tell. Sometimes he tells two stories in a half an hour, sometimes just one. The characters kind of come in and out. Sometimes characters completely change. Now all of a sudden he's got a sister. He never had a sister before. Now he does. What I enjoy about this particular show, in 2014, if it's a show about a straight white dude who's having problems, I want him to interrogate the fact that it's about a straight white dude. I want there to be a position coming out of this. For example, Marc Maron has a show kind of similar. Curb Your Enthusiasm, you could say, is similar to this. Both of those examples of interrogation, of being a straight white male in 2014, they come out with a bitterness. They come out with an anger. And it seems to me that the thing that defines the show is that Louis C.K. is evincing a sadness that can kind of shade over into self-pity very easily. And when it does, he calls himself out on it. He doesn't let himself get away with a lot. That's the kind of sense I get. And that's what I really dig about the show. And that's why I think it's funny.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, there's an intense self-awareness going on and an intense, I think, desire to at least, whether you'd call it sensitivity, it's at least a desire to look at things from angles other than his own. But it's interesting, Linda, you said in the beginning, you know, it's billed as a comedy, it's won a ton of awards as a comedy, and, you know, it has some DNA of some major comedy, I don't want to say brands, just comedy sensibilities. It has a bit of a Seinfeld sensibility, as a bit of a Curb Your Enthusiasm sensibility. There's a bit of a Woody Allen sensibility,
yeah.
just even in just the way it's framed. You know, it comes up as a word on a black screen and sometimes with old jazz music playing, and you think, is this Woody Allen? But at the same time, like, I'll watch an episode and, you know, it's framed like Seinfeld by little bits of his stand-up. They'll use it over the credits. They'll use it to frame the story a little bit. And there are times where I'll watch an entire episode. It's, you know, I'm watching it on Netflix or whatever, and it's like 20 minutes long. And then there's the little stand-up bit, and I realize that's the first time I laughed.
Yeah.
Yeah. I have to tell the truth. I struggle with this show. This show is both my friends who write about television and many of my other friends are pretty much to a person big fans of this show. There's no kind of I belong to XYZ category of people who tend to struggle with this show a little more than
right.
other people. I just struggle with this show, and I struggle with it because I'm not as sure as Glenn is that he really interrogates the stuff that I see in it as much as I wish he would. It's so tied up in the fact that he's playing himself, sort of, and it's semi-autobiographical. I cannot remember ever seeing a television project develop such a cult around a person where you are almost really not allowed to question the genius of the person. And the person can say pretty much anything they want about race, about gender, about anything. And people say, well, if anyone else said this, I would probably think it was racist or sexist or something like that. But it's him, so I know he means it in a satirical kind of way. And for me, it's like, I don't always enjoy the stuff where his life seems to be an endless series of crazy women coming at him and yelling at him about things. Like, I get a lot of, you know, ladies be crazy from this show sometimes. Mm. And it really is off-putting to me. And I think, like I said, it's a very peculiar reaction for me because I don't hate the show. I don't think the show comes from any kind of ugly place. But for me, it's a lot of kind of him rubbing his head being beleaguered by women. It's, for me, it's a lot of that.
I think there's some of that. I think that also happens with men. I think where I would compare this show very directly to Curb Your Enthusiasm. Curb Your Enthusiasm is a super rich guy, and all he wants is to just stay out of any obligation possible. And Louis, he is a much poorer person, and he's just trying to maneuver his way around the way life kind of comes at him. I've seen sort of an unusual cross-section of this show. I happen to have seen two episodes where schlumpy 46-year-old Louis C.K. is aggressively seduced by 25-year-old blonde women, which is where some of the Woody Allen stuff that really bugs me comes in. Yeah. I think there's a real attempt to interrogate things that are not necessarily interrogated in other shows like it.
Yeah. Petra, why don't you talk about you said you struggled with it a bit also.
I'm being awfully quiet right now because I had never watched it before. It is the kind of show that I run a mile from. Stand-up comedy makes me itch. Sitcoms make me itch. Awkwardness makes me itch. Yeah. So I
cringe comedy, not your bag.
I basically needed a gallon of calamine lotion to get through the episodes of this show that I watched, and at certain points, I couldn't look at the screen.
Yeah.
I was listening to it and at the same time playing around with a cutesy Japanese photo manipulation app on my phone and making portraits of cats. See? 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 Look at this. What's on this phone? See? I was doing this during the pilot episode of Louis. Okay. Glenn, tell me what is on this phone.
You've put in the work. It is a cat surrounded by flowers.
I had to get away.
Yeah.
Okay. I understand that this says more about me and my poor taste than the quality of the show. Basically, this show took the awkward, almost universally despised high school loser that I've been trying to bury all of these years and dragged her kicking and screaming out of this colorful protective carapace and poked her with a stick. and that kind of stuff doesn't make me feel any kind of universal kinship or, I'm so glad other people feel the same way. It makes me want to run the heck away.
That's a really interesting reaction. I had a conversation within the last day or two with a friend who loves this show and said, I watch it as comfort food. And it's funny because there's a story about Louis C.K. This is Monday, May 5th, and there's a story today in the New York Times where the headline is like, discomfort food.
Yeah,
you know, the return of, you know, Louis C.K. I was like, comfort food? What? And she said, well, I'm a very awkward person, and I can really connect into the way these are the trials of an awkward person, and I can connect to it, and I see the way that I'm trying to maneuver through. And I thought, gosh, because I feel like I tried to bury the awkward person that I have been. And so some of the awkwardness of that and some of my tendency to avoid cringe comedy is, it's just a little too close to home. And like, God, if I were in that situation, I would hate it. Oh, I could see myself doing that. Ugh. And I don't find Louis to be comfort food. But when I watch it, I always think, this isn't quite doing it for me. I should try another episode.
It seems to me that the character exists in a defensive crouch. He's like basically a defensive crouch in a black t-shirt. And things happen to him. Mm-hmm. He has a fundamental passivity that somebody like Maron in Maron Show or somebody like Larry David in Curb Your Enthusiasm does not have, because they're sensitive to perceived slights. And if they get a perceived slight, they go after somebody.
Right.
This guy, it's all inward focused. It's all I'll give you an example of a scene that didn't work on me, but I understand its appeal, I guess. I think it's in the second season. He is driving to see his great aunt with his kids in the back. He turns on the radio and he rocks out to The Who's Who Are You?
I woke up in a Soho Broadway, a policeman knew my name.
He's blasting the music and the kids are rolling their eyes. And it struck me that this thing that straight white dudes do, where they totally lose all their self-consciousness to rock out to hard rock and roll, man, was shown up as a sad and pitiable thing that doesn't connect him with his kids. It distances him from his kids. And it seems to me the show is about this guy who goes through life thinking that what applies to him applies to everyone, and he keeps getting shown that that is not true. I like that message.
And here's the thing I think that bugs me a little bit. You say that he doesn't go after people like other comics do, but in a certain sense, it's sort of this passive-aggressive celebration of what I'm now going to hideously mispronounce, the l'esprit de l'escalier, you know, where you only think about the right thing to say in a situation when you're already on the stairs heading home. You know, he has these stand-up comedy interstitial bits where he has the space to kind of process things and then spit them out again in a way that is not more favorable to him, but that he gets to say sort of more intelligent or more well-thought-out things, whereas in the moment he's just kind of going and rubbing his head.
Yeah.
And I like that to a certain degree, because don't we all wish we could do that? But it came across to me on screen as passive-aggressive.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not going to argue that he's not passive-aggressive, but I would put a lot more passive into the aggressive than that.
Yeah, I think he's certainly less likely to lash out than some of the other people you're talking about. I think one of my fundamental objections to the show is entirely personal, which is the number of people that have come up to me and been like, oh, you should be watching Louie.
Yeah.
What does that say about you? Stephen, what does that say about you?
That's... Yeah. It's a funny thing because as I said, I really struggle with this show because so many people who I admire and know are smart like it so much that I have tried a number of times. Because there are certain shows that I watch a couple episodes and, you know, I'm not in the right headspace, I'm not in the right mood. I don't hook into them. But then I come back to them later and I hook into them fine and I love them and I come to really adore them as favorite shows. That's happened once or twice. I have been back to this show a number of times, trying again to kind of hook into it. There are isolated moments that I think are brilliant and wonderful. And if the reputation that this show had were it's very uneven, but the stuff that is good is really good, and a lot of the rest of it is kind of throwaway. But you can admire the experimental nature of what he's doing, especially formally. I wouldn't feel quite so out of step with kind of the critical reception that this show has gotten. But this kind of like, thank God this show is back. It's the most brilliant, genius, special. Yeah. I don't feel it. And I never write about it because I don't want to come across like a contrarian. I'm not trying to rain on anybody's parade. It's not one of those shows where it really bothers me that people like it. It doesn't.
You don't find it offensive?
I don't find it offensive. I find it off-putting at times. I think its relationship with women is uncomfortable for me in a way that is not, I think, the intended kind of uncomfortable. Mm. But that's a me thing, and I can kind of let that go. It's just not my bag, and I feel like it seems to be everybody else's bag.
Well, I think you should listen to that because one thing you can't say about this show is, you know, it would be better if it wasn't done by committee. It would be better if he had more time because that's what he gets. He gets the time he needs all the time and complete creative control.
Oh, so, and I mean, it's 14 very short episodes. Yeah. It's been off the air for more than a year.
It's because he makes it for like $12.
Absolutely.
And I mean, we've talked, you know, I've had conversations with people, especially in recent weeks. I've had this conversation a few times about different things, which is the fewer rules you want to follow and the fewer restrictions you want imposed on you, the less resources you have to ask for. And he's really the master of making that work for him. Because like you say, he has tremendous control over that show.
Yeah.
You know, I'm glad in that way. You know, it's funny because Stephen and I have both seen a little bit of the new season. I suspect Stephen is going to know what I'm talking about when I say there's a moment that is so welcome to me in mm-hmm. some ways.
This is in the third episode.
Yeah. A conversation with this woman. And it's so welcome in some ways. And yet it's her talking about her lived experience. And in a way, you want to say, I'm really glad, as Glenn was saying, he's interested in the lived experiences of someone other than himself. But at the same time, I had that moment of being like, I really want this to be a show about her, not a show about her as seen by him or as a freaking, like, that she exists to, like, teach him something. Mm-hmm. But you got to watch it. It's the third episode. It's very, very interesting.
I was going to say, that will be on May 12th.
Yeah.
It's that third episode.
Yeah. It's very interesting. So I think people love it. It's just not, I'm struggling. I haven't given up. I'm struggling.
For me, there's a scene in the first episode of the new season in which he goes into the doctor's office, and the doctor is played by Charles Grodin. And there's a long stretch in which Charles Grodin is noisily eating a sandwich. And if you know me, you know that noisy eating is a trigger. Mm-hmm. It just sets me off. It actually nauseates me. Mm-hmm. One thing I admire about the show is that it is willing to try to simultaneously repel and attract you. It's a very interesting show.
Yeah. Alrighty. Well, I like it. I suspect that most of you like Louis because that is my experience of the universe, including people who are kind of otherwise, you know, in tune with us.
Yeah, but you're going to get people coming out of the woodwork on the Facebook page saying, thank you, Linda, for saying exactly what you did.
More people will yell at me, but that's okay. I am strong. I can take it. But come find us and tell us what you think. And as I said, this is now back for the fourth season. That third episode, as Stephen said, will air on the 12th. And if you're curious about the show, that's to me about as good. That's as much as I can hook into it. So I would look for that one. It's called, I believe, And So Did the Fat Lady. And that's the third episode. So that brings us to our final segment. What is making us happy this week? Stephen Thompson, what is making you happy this week?
Musical theater.
Good for you.
You know, I figured, you know, Trey Graham, mm-hmm. he's riding the rails. Mm-hmm. I would take
his bindle.
With his bindle.
He's just in the back of a boxcar.
Just going from lavish Broadway musical to lavish off-Broadway musical.
Eating a can of beans.
Yes, with a salad fork.
Well, I took in a musical theater production over the weekend. My beloved son has been bitten by the theater bug, and he is part of the stage crew for the Tacoma Park Middle School production of Beauty and the Beast.
There you go.
Oh, awesome.
And first of all, the intensity of the joy that he has just expressed to me as part of this tribe of people. And he'd been talking about it for weeks, and I go to a production, and I walk into this thing, like, he's like, well, it's going to be 90 minutes long. And I just go, 90 minutes long. And it was fantastic. This is 6th, 7th, and 8th graders, and they were amazing. I don't know if, like, theater kids have gotten more talented since my generation or if I just went to a very small high school.
Yeah, it's the beef hormones.
But they make them taller, and they perform with more flair.
Yeah. You might be slightly biased.
I might be slight, but he's not in the production. He's just of the production, and it was wonderful. These kids were so fantastic. It made me vow on the spot to take in more musical theater, provided it is directly linked to someone in my family.
Stephen, you got to get him a young adult graphic novel called Drama, which is about kids who are the tech crew of a play. It is so funny. It's so endearing.
And sweet and lovely.
Leave it to our pal Glenn Weldon to turn my self-indulgent diatribe into an actual recommendation.
There you go.
So it's so nice for Glenn to be able to say, like, you should check out this graphic novel, and that he has someone in the room to go, yeah!
Right. See? Thank you.
I wasn't planning to actually recommend anything people could see because Beauty and the Beast has closed, but I will say there is a fantastic new album streaming on NPR Music about to be released on May 13th by a duo called Sylvan Esso, and it is Amelia Meath, who was one of the singers in this group called Mountain Man, which was this kind of a cappella folk group. And then this guy named Nick Sanborn, who plays bass in this kind of psychedelic rock band called Megaphone, but here he's doing all this electronic stuff. So it's two people slightly outside their comfort zone playing this beautiful, evocative, very ambivalent, gorgeous music. She's this very expressive singer, but very slyly and subtly expressive singer, performing with all this, you know, beautiful kind of three-dimensional sound pinging all around her. And it's just a beautiful record. I really, really love it. Actually, let's hear a little bit of the song Coffee.
Get up, get down. Get up, get down. Feel the general rotation and stop. See the next one waiting. Get up, get down. Get up, get down. Get up. Sit in the scene with a pair of feet chained.
So that's Coffee by Sylvan Esso. The album is self-titled. It comes out May 13th. For the next few days, you'll be able to listen to it at NPR Music. But it is wonderful. One of my favorite albums of the year.
Thank you, Stephen Thompson. Petra Mayer, what is making you happy this week?
What's making me happy right now is my memories of being a teenage theater geek. Because I have to say, if you're that age, being able to wear black and order people around is the greatest bit of character development that you could ever possibly experience.
There are very many very wonderful adults who would trace the beginning of their true happiness to "Then I met the theater kids."
Oh, that makes me so happy. I'm very, very happy about everything about it.
Uh-huh. But what's also making me happy this week, three words, teenage nun assassins. If you want to actually get more elaborate, I can give you six words.
No, let's just leave it there.
Teenage nun assassins in medieval Brittany. There's a series called His Fair Assassin, which I discovered a couple years ago via the AV Club, which had a column for a while called YAY, which was devoted to recommending or at least analyzing interesting young adult releases. And they kicked it off with this book called Grave Mercy, which was about a teenage nun assassin in medieval Brittany. And I love these books because, speaking of ass-kicking female characters and a whole world of women, it's actually kind of apropos considering what we've been discussing. They're set in this medieval setting and they imagine a pre-Christian pantheon of gods, one of whom is sort of Christianized into a saint, a god of death, and he has a convent that takes in foundlings and trains them to be assassins. And so you have these young women who are very good at what they do, and they get involved in court intrigue, and they kick French ass, and they save Brittany, and they have lovely, strong relationships with each other. The final volume in the trilogy is called Mortal Heart, and I just got an advance copy of it. So I read it in one go over the weekend, and it had all of the things I love, and it also had this beautifully drawn relationship between the heroine and her mystery lover. And this sounds kind of academic, but it was the most marvelous modeling of consent that I've seen in young adult literature.
Oh,
she
nice.
Takes agency. She goes to him. She says, "Let's get it on." He says, "Are you sure? I want you to be sure." He obtains elaborate consent. They go ahead and do it, and she feels fantastic about it afterwards. She is happy. And it was so healthy and sane and refreshing. I thought, God, every teenage girl should have this book. She's 17, I guess, so it's not young. But anyways, it's called Mortal Heart. The whole series is called His Fair Assassin. The last book isn't out until November, but the rest of them are out now. If you want to read them, they're a really fun weekend read, and also teenage nun assassins. Got to keep saying that.
Sure, absolutely. Is it His Fair Assassin as in His, capital H, the Lord?
Yeah.
Much better.
Awesome. Wonderful. Thank you, Petra Mayer. Glenn Weldon, what is making you happy this week?
First of all the people who went to Free Comic Book Day and wrote about it on the blog page and the Facebook page, including Brooke Moose, who took her 9-year-old daughter. She had a terrible experience last year at Free Comic Book Day because there was a surly shopkeep. But this year she went to a different store and found somebody who was wonderful. And so that brought a weary smile to this grizzled old face. But the book I want to recommend is a new graphic novel called The Undertaking of Lily Chen. It's by Danica Novgorodov. Novgorodoff, Novgorodov. It is set in rural northern China of today. It's the story of a young guy who is held responsible for the death of his older brother, and so his family forces him to go out and find a fresh female corpse to bury with his brother, because there's this tradition of the ghost bride, which is actually still going on in certain parts of rural China, where the older brother must be married, even if he's dead, so he has somebody to go with into the afterlife. So there's a black market for fresh female corpses in certain parts, where they go and they dig up women. And it was a story about this in The Economist not too long ago, which dealt with it in kind of a supply and demand kind of way, because there's only a certain number of bachelors and a lot and not enough female corpses for them to be buried with. So some people are driven to murder. It's this dark, weird thing, but this book is so sharp and bright. There is, the art of this is fantastic. It's really gorgeous because it's very cartoony characters against this very lush backdrop of this landscape. She studied Chinese brush painting to kind of get that tone exactly right. It is so weird and you have no idea where it's going. He meets the Lily Chen of the title, and she's a great character, and it just goes in all these weird places. It's a picaresque novel, so he keeps meeting all these different people along the way, and it's really weirdly funny. So that's The Undertaking of Lily Chen by Danica Lovgorodov.
Wonderful. Thank you, Glenn Weldon. Making me happy this week, I have sort of a grab bag of little things. First of all, I assume that you are all regular readers of my pal Stephen Thompson's column, The Good Listener, at NPR Music. This week's column is about whether there's such a thing as an artist selling out. And it talks about what happens when somebody's song is in a commercial and suddenly the fact that they are perhaps making a tiny amount of money brings them all sorts of resentment. And it's a really, I thought, fantastic piece. And very much enjoyed reading it. So that's A. B is that they sent me in the mail, and by they, I mean the toy people, sent me in the mail a big, very heavy War Machine figure that I have been gradually working on putting together at my desk. He came mostly assembled, but I have to put all kinds of little button batteries in his head to make his eyes light up and stuff like that. So I've been gradually working on assembling War Machine. And the best part of this has been that the other day somebody came by my desk and basically was like, I thought you cleaned your desk. You told me a while ago that you cleaned your desk. And I was like, this is all War Machine. This is all parts and stuff from War Machine and packaging from War Machine. He was like, okay, I get it. Mm-hmm. So I got to explain that my desk was only messy because of War Machine. That was B. C is that if you have not been reading the column by friend of the show, by which I mean person we like, Dave Holmes, no relation to me, Somewhere in Time at Vulture, it goes back and looks at a set of songs or shows or movies from a particular point in history. And it's a wonderful kind of weirdly discursive, like sometimes it's just, you know, sometimes there's a little bit of free flowing, like I don't really have anything to say about this song, so I'm just going to talk about what was going on at the time. But other times it's just these... this is the entry, for example. The most recent one is a set of the top 40 singles from summer 1986. It's called Dave Holmes Looks Back at the Fetch Hits of Summer 1986 when Lindsay Lohan arrived in the world. The entry, he goes through each song that was in the top 40. The entry for number 28, Hearts Nothing at All, says, there is very little to discuss in this song, but I think you will agree that its record sleeve, which he links to, is the 80s-est thing ever. It's like Max Headroom had sex with Alexis from Dynasty, and this is what they wiped themselves off with.
Yep. This is what they wiped themselves off.
And if you look at the record sleeve, you will see that it is true.
I can't unsee that. Thanks, Linda.
Don't thank me. Thank Dave Holmes, who writes these wonderful Somewhere in Time columns. He's done ones that are about the movies that were popular at a particular time.
And that same one is actually kind of poignant in places because he's talking about this guy that he remembers from high school, from some kind of camp. And it goes to a very surprising, legitimately moving place.
They're wonderful, wonderful pieces. And it's like, it's kind of what I used to tell people about writing recaps of television was that the best thing about it was that it was such a blank slate. And you could kind of use it as a way to, you know, some people more than others, but you could kind of use it as a way to kind of just talk about different stuff and veer around and do your own thing. And some entries are short and some are long. And it's they're wonderful. Again, the series is called Somewhere in Time. It's at Vulture. And you should definitely read
Dave
it because it's
Holmes.
Awesome.
That man is a treasure.
Yeah, we love him. Like I said, friend of the show in the sense of person we like. And so that is what is making me happy this week. And that brings us to the end of our show. You can follow all of us on Twitter. You can follow me at NPR Monkey C. You can follow Stephen at I Dislike Stephen, STEPHEN. You can follow Petra at Petramatic. That's PETRAMATIC, Petramatic. You can follow Glenn at GH Weldon, WELDON. You can follow our producer, Lauren Migaki at L Migaki, MIGAKI, and our producer Jessica Reedy at Jessica Reedy, Jessica_Reedy, REEDY. And of course, you can follow our esteemed producer, emeritus, and music director, Mike Katziff at Mike Katziff, KATZIF. Mike's band, Hello, Come In, provides our in and out music, which you are tapping your foot to right now. So thank you to all of you for being here.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And thanks to all of you for listening, and we will see you back here next week.